This is an interview with Judge Pat Kerrigan for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by Michael Graham at his offices in Youngstown, Ohio on October 24th, 1991 at 12 p.m.
Okay, we'll start out with something relatively simple. If you would you please just tell me about your childhood, your background growing up?
I am the oldest child of six children born to Thomas Tammy Kerrigan and Lenore McLaughlin Kerrigan. I was born in 1950, lived on the north side for a few years, very few years, and then on the east side with my grandparents, then on the west side, and then we moved to the south side of Youngstown when I was about to start first grade. I went to St. Dominic's grade school. I skipped a grade. I went from fourth to sixth grade. I was a very bright student, very high IQ, and got B's without ever even looking at a book and doing any homework. Bit of a discipline problem as well. But then I graduated. I was 12, graduated from 8th grade and went on to Cardinal Mooney High School. Graduated there when I was 16. And from there I went to the University of Notre Dame. Graduated in 1971 at the age of 20. Got a full scholarship to Akron Law School. Graduated in 1974. Went from there to the Attorney General's office in Columbus, where I began my legal career and was an assistant attorney general. My father died when I was 14. I was a sophomore in high school. Matter of fact, 27 years ago, the day before yesterday, October 22nd, 1964. That obviously was a very big influence in my life. Again, being the oldest of six kids, I was expected to do an awful lot in terms of leadership for the family and in terms of paying my own way. Started my first job as I was a janitor at Cardinal Mooney when I was a freshman. I was just turned 13, and I worked there, and I really worked off and on since then. Worked either in the summer times or during school as a janitor. When I was at Notre Dame, I worked in the bookstore. I always seemed to have one job or another someplace. I come from a very large Irish Catholic family on both sides, really. On my mother's side of the family, I'm one of 44 grandchildren. That's just one side. My mother was one of 10. They're a very large, I believe, intelligent and articulate, very aggressive. We've got doctors, probably a dozen lawyers in the group. Great family, you know, the type of family that everybody had something to say and was always encouraged to say it. And we ever went to we have a lot of family reunions, and if you ever went there, it'd be hard to get a word in edgewise unless you were articulate and aggressive. And I used to always marvel at them because the great aunts and the uncles and the little kids would all converse with each other like they were equals, and we always prided ourselves on the fact that you better be able to give and take and converse with everybody, and we always did. And so I think that's one of the reasons we have people that, you know, very highly educated group. And my own immediate family, I have one brother and four sisters. All of them graduated from college. Five out of the six have postgraduate degrees. There's another lawyer in the group. One has an MBA. One has a master's in education. You know, they're just a pretty well-educated group. That's something my mom felt very strongly about. My mother remarried when I was a senior in high school to a guy, interestingly enough, that she had dated in high school and who had never been married. He was a very quiet guy. Didn't really have much of an influence on my life, except to the extent that he was a stabilizing influence for my younger siblings and was financial support to me and to my mom. Obviously, with my father dying, it was very difficult for me to go to Notre Dame. But with the insurance proceeds from my dad and loans and, again, the jobs that I had and my stepfather's life savings, we were able to do it. My father had graduated from Notre Dame back in 1944, and especially being in an Irish Catholic family, but also being the son of a Notre Dame graduate, that was a very important thing that I'd be able to go to Notre Dame, and I was able to do so. And again, I graduated in 1975 with a degree in government.
Okay. You mentioned you were with the Attorney General. What were your duties? What was a typical day like?
Well, it was very much like a large law firm. The Attorney General, among other things, his primary function is to be the lawyer for all the agencies and departments of state government. Now, some of those departments are so large that they require their whole section of lawyers and a team of lawyers. So, Environmental Protection Agency, there might be a section there with 5 to 10 lawyers and secretaries, and that's all they do is represent the Environmental Protection Agency. Consumer Fraud represents the Consumer Fraud Division of the Department of Commerce and also does their own prosecutorial type of work, but very similar to what things a lawyer might do in practice. I was in a section that was called at first it was called the Administrative Agencies Section, and we changed the name and I moved around from department as we reorganized. I was there for 5 years, but my function remained essentially the same. I represented a wide variety of administrative agencies in the state of Ohio and was their lawyer and provided them legal advice on a day-to-day basis, provide them written legal advice as to the interpretation of state laws and administrative regulations which were either adopted by them or by their predecessors, and represented them anytime they were sued, and prosecuted cases. Administrative agencies are, for the most part, regulatory agencies who issue licenses. So anytime they prosecuted somebody for a violation of the laws or the regulations to either suspend them or to revoke their licenses, I would prosecute. Once we took such action on the administrative agency level, there were often appeals. So I did an awful lot of appellate work. Even if you went to the Common Pleas Court, which is normally a trial court, it was on an appeal from an administrative agency, so it was mainly brief work rather than trial work. Then we often went to the Court of Appeals and even to the Ohio Supreme Court. So in 5 years, I was in every Court of Appeals district in the state, and I was in the Ohio Supreme Court half a dozen, maybe 10 times, actually arguing cases, whereas many lawyers will practice an entire career with ever having been to the Supreme Court. I actually got to the point where I was very comfortable with that, you know, and it was very much a standard procedure for me to either go to the Court of Appeals or to the Ohio Supreme Court. Typical day would be going to the office and, you know, working 9 to 5 and answering a multitude of phone calls, writing written opinions, either informal or formal, that would be published, relating to the matters representing my agencies. During the course of the period that I was there, I represented such diverse groups as the Board of Embalmers and Funeral Directors of Ohio, the Division of Licensing of the Department of Commerce, which licenses auctioneers and private investigators. A big client was the Real Estate Commission, which licenses all brokers and real estate salespeople in the state of Ohio, the Board of Psychology. I did a little bit for the hearing aid dealers and fitters and the Ohio State Medical Board. Ohio State Racing Commission was a fascinating client. They would meet monthly all over the state at various racetracks, and we'd get to go to the racetrack and we'd have the meetings right there, and you got to meet all the jockeys and the representatives of the jockeys unions and the stewards, and you got passes that I could go back to any place on a racetrack, except where they had the money. But my pass entitled me to go anywhere, regardless of normal restrictions. Then by the time I got done with my career, I had accumulated
from one client or another, from one prior lawyer or another, the auditor of state, the treasurer of state, and the secretary of state. I was their counsel. So anytime any of them got sued, I represented the case. And I handled cases that were multi-million dollar cases. Wasn't a multi-million dollar case in the same case that if you had a severe accident and you got a $50 million judgment and the lawyer made a few million and everybody made a few million, but there were a $150 million case, but it was transferring it from the wildlife fund to the general fund or from the highway repair fund to some other fund. There's a lot of fighting going on about the procedures maybe that the auditor used, which account to credit, and there was often legislation that went on a regular basis. One of the things that I learned early on and was involved with that it stood me in good stead, at least politically, in administration of justice, is the ability to deal with the media. My cases in those days were in, especially in the state capitol, in a newspaper that was geared towards state government, was my cases were in the newspaper on a regular basis. I was constantly being interviewed. May not have made as much airtime on TV, but the case did, you know, and it was always a source of comment. I was always reading about my cases in a paper, and I was able to deal with that and, you know, present the best foot forward and always believed very strongly in being open and honest about government, and that's why I, you know, I'm known in town, hopefully not for being a loudmouth, but known for being open and honest with the media. If they ever have a question, I'm always the one that they come to, it seems, because I'm much more accessible than other people.
Okay. How did you get interested in getting into politics? And
well, I like to maintain the position of not being too much of a political hack. I was a good lawyer. I think that we need good lawyers to be judges. That's how you get good judges. So I've always tried to maintain a little bit of a distinction. I don't merge my avocation with my vocation, and pure politics is not my game. Maybe let me put it this way. Pure politics is not my business. However, it is my game in the sense that I've been fascinated with politics all my life. Again, this large Irish Catholic family, they kind of have a tradition of being interested in public affairs and community issues, and politics naturally flows from that. My own father, before he passed away, was very active as a precinct committeeman. He ran for county auditor in 1962, was offered the finance director for the city of Youngstown by the newly elected Mayor Flask in 1963, and he was dead at 64 at the age of in 64 at the age of 42. Many people very strongly suggest that he had been either the county auditor or the mayor or something else because of his success. He hadn't won an election, but he did very well in his first time out. But I got exposed to politics at an early age. In 1968 was my first non-family political and non-school political situation. Even in high school, I was campaign chairman for student body president races, and I was on the student council and this and that. And when I was a freshman at Notre Dame, I was on national staff for Eugene McCarthy in his race for president. There was big anti-war days, and I was kind of an activist. And as a matter of fact, I had an offer to go to California to work for Kennedy, but to work for McCarthy, but I was only 16 years old. Or 17 years old, and I had to be 18 to sign the right waivers. In those days, I was still a juvenile, and I wouldn't be 18 until July 1st, and they couldn't get me out there, even though I was already kind of a political pro. In 1970, my uncle, Attorney Dick McLaughlin, ran for Congress here in Youngstown. Incidentally, he's a very successful attorney locally. He's a member of the Board of Trustees at YSU. But 1970 and 72, he had just come back from Washington, and he'd spent many years there as a lawyer and working for the government and going to law school actually as well. And he came back here and set up private practice and ran for Congress. And so in 1772, I almost dropped out of school, worked very, very hard for his campaigns, was assistant campaign manager and drove him around and just did an awful lot of work. I'd gotten married when I was a junior at Notre Dame and left Notre Dame for a semester. Well, that coincided in 1970, right when he was running the first time. And so I was able to work very extensively on that campaign. And then in 1972, by that point I graduated and I was in law school, and I was able to take some time off from law school to work on his campaign. So in 62, 68, 70, and 72, I mean, I'm only 21 years old, but I worked on four campaigns very extensively already. And again, I think I'd had the possibilities of being a pro at it. And but yet I try to keep that away from my work and my job. And when I was interviewed by the Attorney General's office, I didn't use any political connections, didn't talk about that. I wanted to be recruited to be a lawyer, and I wanted to work as a lawyer, and was in fact recruited as such. Once I got there, then I started getting involved in campaigns there as well. And I worked for Stanton for Senate, Brown for Attorney General. I was the boss then. I worked on his campaigns for governor, got to know all the statewide politicos, and just was stayed very, very active. In 1976, I was a delegate. I was approached because I was in Columbus and was very active in politics and knew a lot of the legislators. I was approached by people working for a variety of candidates for president, asking if I would be on their steering committee and work on their campaign. And it was funny, I kind of had a choice between Vance Hartke and Jimmy Carter. And nobody heard of either one of them. If anything, Vance Hartke was a little more well known. And a friend of mine said, well, he was approached also by the same two, and he said, well, I'm going to go with Hartke. So I said, well, you go with Hartke. As a matter of fact, the person who said this was, he's a county commissioner now, Tom Carney. He was a state rep at the time and a very good friend. And he and I talked about it. He said, well, I'm going with Hartke. I said, okay, you go with Hartke, I'll go with Carter. Within a month, Hartke had dropped like a rock into a deep pool of water and didn't even get reelected as a senator, let alone have any serious consideration as president. And of course, with Carter, he came from nowhere and became president. Well, in 1976, I ran his campaign in Mahoning County in the primary. I was a delegate, went to the national convention as an elected delegate for Carter, and I was at the age of 25. I was a chairman of the youth caucus for Carter in Ohio. Made a lot of contacts that way. And then ran the campaign in the fall, the successful election campaign. And then in 1980, again, worked on his campaign. I wasn't as involved and let somebody else run as a delegate. He was a sitting president, and I already had my chance, my fun, you know, as a delegate. So, but in between, I loved campaigns. I just always was interested in it. And really not as a way to make money or as a way to get a job. I never really worked other than the Attorney General's office, and that wasn't really a patronage situation. That was, you know, you were hired to be a lawyer. I never had a job working for government. When I came back, I did a little bit of work for the Bureau of Support for a couple months, but I wasn't interested in those type of positions. I wanted to be a lawyer, and I wanted to do my politics on the side. And I'm one of the few people, lawyers don't often get involved in the nuts and bolts aspects of politics. I mean, you talk to a lawyer in Youngstown today, and they think they're very politically astute, and their idea of being involved is to give a $100 check to somebody running for office and to talk about it over lunch, you know. And whereas I put up signs, I put the signs together, I write my own copy for my ads, I devise my own campaign strategy. I mean, I just have done it all, you know, and knew when I ran what I wanted to do. And I was a little surprised myself when I ran. I didn't know that I would be running as a candidate so soon. It really wasn't something that I planned. I knew I would be running sometime, but I didn't think at the age of 36 that I would go for it quite so soon.
Okay. Let's get into being a judge. What would you say are your typical duties, or, you know, again, a typical day as...
Well, the Youngstown Municipal Court is the court where I am working now. I was elected to that position in 1987. I had a 6-year term. I succeeded Judge Krizen, who had been a judge for, I'm not sure, somewhere between 15 and 20 years, I believe. And he had to retire because he was over the age of 70 when his term came up. And for a young person to be elected to that position. And it's a full-time job. We're not allowed to practice on the side. As you're interviewing me, you can see that I have, I'm going to say, 4 feet of paperwork that I'm trying to sign while we're talking here. These are all civil cases. There's a great volume of civil work here that people don't appreciate. Attachments, lawsuits, default judgments, motions. I can't say that we have any major automobile accident cases or personal injury lawsuits or big corporation battles or anything like that. Our jurisdiction is $10,000. We don't handle any cases over that. But we certainly have a great volume, small claims and cases all the way up to $10,000. So there's a lot of paperwork involved with that. A typical day always seems to involve, at one point or another, some sort of criminal cases. There's three kinds of cases you can do. You can do traffic, which has some criminal penalties, such as DUIs, driving under suspension, things like that. Criminal and civil. The way it's set up in the court, there's three judges here, and every day we have some involvement with some criminal cases. So if there's one thing that you say, that what do you do most often, what do you do every day, and what do you spend most of your time or attention at, it would be criminal. And that's certainly what the public perceives. You know, I'm on the TV or in the newspaper constantly. Well, nobody really cares about the civil case. You know, they're there because a murderer was arraigned in front of me, or somebody else had some charge here and there. So those are the cases that you do. But my typical day is I get here about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'll spend a half hour getting prepared for the day, talking to lawyers who've got cases coming up and dealing with that. And then from 9:30 to noon, I'm on the bench most days. I have cases that are contested. There's a lot of pleas. We have a great volume. I'm in a slow day. We'll have 5 or 10 cases. A busy day, we'll have 50 cases. And we have two kinds. One is the kind of people that come in for their very first appearance. If they plead not guilty, that's pretty much it. We set it for trial. We have some discussion of the facts, set bond, appoint lawyers, this and that. And those usually don't take too long. If they plead no contest, we get into a little more discussion of the facts, the prior criminal record, what the police officers say, what the prosecutor recommends, and maybe make sentencing right then that day. And then after those are called arraignments. Then we get into the cases that were scheduled for trial that day, people that had already been to court on an arraignment, whether it be my court or another court, and had been told to come back and have your trial. Now we've got a courtroom full of witnesses for these cases as well, and we try to settle those or plead them or have trials, whatever the case may be, and work out some sort of arrangement. Those usually take longer, but again, most of those end up in people ending up pleading to the charges. And we pretty much do that all day, all morning, trying to resolve those cases. And, you know, many people will go to jail, many people will have fines, a lot of probation. Jails are overcrowded, and we have no way to deal with that. But, those are high emotions. We're talking about people that... you know, they could go to jail for 6 months or a year. They could be fined a lot of money. Their lives can be ruined. You know, it's very tense, very emotionally draining. That may be the one of the most important moments of the lives of the people in front of me that day. So again, it's, you have to be very careful and very diligent and very conscientious of their rights. It's a lot of lawyers, a lot of pressure, a lot of, you know, competing interests. You're trying to balance the, you don't have to be fair. Some people, maybe they do things a lot differently than you were ever brought up to do, and, you know, the culture within which they live accepts things a lot differently than what you would expect. But you can't impose your morality on them. You have to try to take yourself out of your, in my case, white middle class background and say, okay, now, well, wait a minute, you know, these people are uneducated, maybe they're poor, maybe they're not from around here, maybe they're from the South, or maybe they live in the ghetto, or maybe this, or maybe that, and try to, you know, see who's really evil and who's just maybe a victim of circumstances. And in any event, the most of the morning is dealt with those cases and sending people to jail or not sending them to jail. Myself, I often work through lunchtime, but sometimes we'll get out for lunch. And then the afternoon, I generally try to do as much civil work as I can. We have trials set every day. They often will get continued, but you know, you have to show up and let them work it out, settle the case before you go. There's an awful lot of paperwork. Again, as you can see, I've got yards of material here to review, and I've got to do that during the day, sign all these things. Some I don't even have to read, I just have to sign my name. Some of them I have to read and approve referees' reports and things like that. And then there's just the general housekeeping details that are involved. Especially the civil has a great amount of work to do, but even the criminal, there's a lot of follow-up. People say, well, you know, you go to court for 3 hours and then what do you do for the rest of the day? Well, you'd be amazed, especially I take great pride in the creative sentencing and the aggressive probation department that I've helped create and that I maintain and that I try to utilize, especially in view of the overcrowded jail situation that we have. So I'm always releasing people really to go to drug rehab and violating people's probation for not doing what they're supposed to do. Send them to counseling of all sorts for, well, there's a place that's actually a school that teach people not to shoplift. It's called Stoplift. I refer an awful lot of shoplifters there. I got drug and alcohol rehabilitation. I have battered persons crisis center, mental health counseling, all sorts of things like that, that my probation department's always in and out saying, well, you know, you sent this guy here and here's their evaluation and here's what I recommend, and then I bring him down and talk to him and let him out on probation or community service or work release from jail. All those details. Nothing happens in a court unless the judge signs his name to it. Nothing that we can do, I can order you to do anything, unless I put it down in writing, put it on a case, and put it in what we call journalize it, put it in a journal. You know, maybe I get respect because I said it and I'm a judge, but technically it has no force of law unless I write it down. So they're constantly coming in, okay, well, you said to send him here and we found the right place, so now you got to write it down. So I got to pull out the file, write it down, journalize all the things that I do. And, you know, we just have a great deal of office work to do in the afternoons.
Two questions. First one, how does aggressive probation work? And the second one is, you're talking about the emotions that people go through. How do you deal with that? I mean, you know, that's got to put a lot of stress on you as taking charge of or being responsible for a person's life like that.
First of all, aggressive probation, I'll answer that question first. What I mean by that is one of the things that I do, let's say you're charged with beating up your wife. You'd get 6 months in jail for that, $1,000 fine. Some judges, they'll give you the full 6 months and $1,000 fine, and then they'll suspend something. Well, I never do that. I'll give you what I expect you to do if you violate probation. They'll give you 6 months, and then you violate it, and they won't send you to jail or anything, because they don't think 6 months is appropriate. But I'll give you 60 days. Maybe it's a little more than you would get normally if you would plead, but I'm saying to you, look, you're going to do 60 days if you violate it, your probation terms. So you know now, don't worry about the 6 months, which is the maximum. You know you got 60 days to do. And I'll give you a $500 fine, because I expect you to pay every penny of that. Maybe I can't expect you to pay a $1,000 fine, so I won't give you that, but I'll give you $500, and I'll suspend most of it. And maybe I'll suspend, even if I suspend all the jail time. So then I got a period of probation of 6 months or a year. I don't believe in anything longer than that. I can't expect these people to remain good for 3 years. Some judges do that. But I want to watch them for 6 months or a year. And if they do make a violation, I'm going to take away their probation and send them to jail. Again, some judge will give you 6 months in jail, suspend it all, put you on 3 years probation. You go back half a dozen times and they won't ever violate you. That's not very good probation to me. I give you 6 months probation, and if you make one mistake, boom, you're going to jail. Then I'm, as part of the probation, I'll do some sort of creative group of alternative sentences. Instead of sending you to jail and you're able-bodied, maybe I'll make you do 50 hours of community service. And in addition to that, I'll make you attend sessions at the Battered Persons Crisis Center for counseling on abuse. More often than not, there's an alcohol component of this or a drug component of the crime. They're not actually charged with that, but they were drunk or high at the time. So I'll send them up for, if not rehabilitation, at least for an evaluation so that they know those services are available to them. Maybe I might have an AIDS or an HIV test or something like that. So I'll get more than one thing. I'll get a couple things going there. So, you know, maybe you're not doing any jail time, but you got suspended sentence hanging over your head. You're being monitored by the probation department. You got to do some counseling. You do the community service. You do a couple of things. You know that you've committed a crime and that you're making restitution to society, if you will, one way or another, by the things that I'm requiring you to do. I might make you take alcohol tests or drug tests on a regular basis or on an anonymous basis, or maybe it's house arrest. I mean, to me, that's probation. You're not being required to go to jail, but you can't leave your house. I mean, you got to stay away from the complaining witness, or you got to stay away from bars, or this or that. So I pose a little, when I say active probation or aggressive probation, I mean there are a lot of conditions imposed upon your probation, and if you violate them, you're going back to jail. Your other question about the dealing with people's emotions, and you know, if you ever had a chance, I teach at YSU. I teach American Criminal Courts, and I make all my students come down to class, because even if you're involved in the process somewhat so far, either as a student or even working in the criminal justice system, unless you see a muni court of a that's not a big city, a municipal environment like this, you just can't believe it. It's absolutely crazy. I mean, I had a guy in court today, for example, who was screaming and swearing and crying. And I mean, he was just he's nuts. I had an incentive sending him up to Woodside. But he was starting to plead with me, and then he was actually yelling at me for this charge. And like, I had nothing to do with the charge. But you have to maintain your cool and, you know, don't get mad. Don't take it out on him. I mean, he didn't know any better. And, you know, send him up to Woodside and try to keep control, because you're a courtroom full of people. And I think I did that successfully. I find that that's a very difficult thing to do. But I guess I've been fortunate to get this job, because this takes advantage of the talents that I have. I mean, God gives all of us certain abilities and certain talents, and the one thing that I pride myself on, I think I do the best at, is I'm a very tolerant, laid-back person. I don't get too excited. You know, I try to keep control. I don't make judgmental decisions over people that just because they're different than I am. I'm very tolerant of the differences in people. And I love people. I find good in a lot of people that maybe somebody else doesn't see, but if you look hard enough, you can find it. I really honestly feel a religious feeling about this job. I look at it as my ministry. Without being corny, the religious component helps me do my job and do God's will, and I really feel that this is where I can help people, I can help society, and I can make a contribution to my community. And if you look at it that way, then you know you become more of a social worker rather than a hanging judge. You know, you can be tolerant. You can understand that. You can understand people's weaknesses and try to deal with them and help them. And if they don't want to be helped, I can be as tough as anybody. But I'm also trying to be compassionate whenever I can, because so many of these people, they're poor souls that need some compassion, need somebody to try to somehow give them a little bit of dignity and respect. And that's all they're asking for. And if you can do that, you know, you've made their day. Even if you're sending them to jail, I get so many people that say, "Judge, that was the best thing that ever happened to me." Or, "Judge, I didn't even do it, but boy, you sure treated me with respect and dignity, and I appreciate that, and you're okay, you know." And I'm considered to be quite righteous by a lot of the people that I send to jail, and they mean that, I think, in a positive way, that I didn't lose my temper, I didn't lose my cool, I didn't impose my values on them. But those are the talents that I have as a person, and they're quite well suited, I think, for this environment.
What are some of the more memorable cases you've decided? Just things, you know, cases that have stuck out in your mind as being, so we say, very important to you.
Well, one of the things that my job involves is that on misdemeanor charges, where you can get a maximum of 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine, we try those cases. We actually have them all the way through. We also have a large number of cases that any felony committed in the city of Youngstown has to come through our court system and has to be sent over to the Common Police Court actually to be tried, but we see them. And so that may be the more dramatic and the more memorable cases in terms of the either the publicity that gets out to the community or the impact that it makes on you, even though you didn't try the case. You get a lot of big cases like that, murders and rapes and kidnappings and things like that. And to be very honest with you, it's hard to say any particular cases, because the cases that make the most impression on you within your soul, so to speak, are the small cases, the poor soul that today that, you know, that's not all there mentally, and that he's pleading with somebody to help him, you know, reach out and help him. Or the prostitute that has a drug problem and that's been there many, many times and that needs help. The guy that came in front of me yesterday, he actually came in front of me 3 days ago, has got a record a mile long for thefts. He told me that the reason he went out and stole these things was because his 10-year-old son had been taken away from him, and his 6-year-old daughter had been taken away from him, and their mother was a junkie, and he wasn't able to take care of them, and his cousin or his aunt was taking care of them, and she turned them back over to him, just dumped them on him, and that he had no money, no food, no way to take care of them. He went out and stole some cigarettes to sell them to raise a little bit of cash to put food on the table. I mean, that brought a tear to my eye. I mean, I felt very sorry for the guy. I let him out of jail. He comes back 2 days later, charged with theft again. You know, so I mean, now I had to slam dunk him. But I mean, you know, that really touched me when he first came in. I felt very bad for the guy. There are a lot of cases like that of people that their lives are poor and miserable, and they're living in abject poverty and abusive situations, and you know, you see so many of those that it's really hard to point out, you know, one as opposed to another. Some of the more interesting cases in terms of media attention and things like that, where this Flip Williams, that Willie Williams is charged with murder. I arraigned him a few weeks ago. Now, I won't try that case, but he was in my court on several occasions relating to that. And I mean, again, that's a very notorious case. He's a very notorious individual. I was struck with how cold he seemed to be and how calculating. He showed no remorse about anything. A few years ago, we had a defendant by the name of Spivey. Was a defendant that had raped and killed a older real estate woman over in the South Side. He was a young black man, a huge size and strength, and also seemed to be very cold, and he was very frightening to think about someone like that being loose. You know, he wasn't very bright, and he was proved to be a killer, and I mean, that's a very frightening proposition to think that there's a kind of an animal like that out there on the loose. And he was very frightening and stuck in my mind. I had the Zupos, the people that a few years ago that kidnapped somebody on the north side, and they never did find his body, and I had set the bond very high on them, and there was a lot of attention about that case. And then they went over to the common pleas court, and the judge lowered the bond, and they fled town, you know. And a lot of people suggested if there was any question about finding the evidence once they fled, that they made sure that there was no evidence to be found. That was a big case because I have a very large black constituency in the city, and so many of the people coming from the court are black, and the blacks seem to take it on the chin very often in terms of penalties and punishment. And here was a case where there were white defendants doing something to a young black man, and they didn't perceive the defendants being treated the same way as if the case had been reversed, you know. And I thought they had a point, and I tried very hard, very carefully, to treat him exactly as I would have any other defendant. And I try to do that in all cases, but in that case in particular, to treat people regardless of their skin color the same as I would treat any other defendant. But that was a pretty interesting and fascinating case. Again, I didn't try it, but I was there while they were doing the searches. I signed search warrants. I set bond. Bond turned out to be a critical factor in the case. I was able to hear a lot of the evidence, deal with the FBI, talk to the detectives, have some of that stuff come through the case, through the court. I've had, I mean, you know, we're in a city that there have been 51 murders, and they've probably been 35 people or 30 people arraigned on those charges. So, you know, I don't know how many I've had, but I've probably had 15 of them come through my court. You know, there's a lot of people there. You know, you see those kinds of cases, even after a while, those tend to, you know, you don't treat them like numbers, but after you're dealing with the case and once it's over, they tend to merge with one another, you know, and there's just been an awful lot of them. Some of the cases of child abuse or sexual imposition on minors are some of the cases that strike me very strongly. I just had the case just the other day that I had the couple that threw their 3-day-old baby down the sewer. They came in front of me. I mean, talk about a sad case there. You know, the parents don't seem to be very bright. They certainly don't have any regard for the life of that child. All they seem to be concerned about is whether or not they were going to get out on bond, and you know, things like that strike you. But it's hard to make a value judgment because I'm not actually going to try the case. They're charged with attempted murder, which is a felony case, and it's pending, so I don't want to say anything more about it than that. But you know, you get those cases literally every day, every week, and they go on and on. So it almost has a numbing effect. It's unbelievable. You know, you have to have a sense of humor and a belief in God, I say all the time, you know, to get through this job, because if you don't, you'd start to get a little crazy.
It's a whole department within the history department. And they've got, I think, 2 or 3 transcribers working full time. So. Okay. Second to last question is, throughout your career, who are some of the more notable people that you've run into? Really struck your fancy.
One of which that immediately comes to mind is attorney Richard McLaughlin, who's my uncle. He's going to get mad at me if I get the year wrong, but I'm going to say he's in his early 50s, 55 maybe. Well, he would have been, 36 in 1970, so that's about right. He's a very intelligent, honest, articulate, well-intentioned, successful person, someone that I admire very much in control, does things for the right reasons, doesn't let himself be intimidated or browbeaten or compromised, and just has been a strong influence on my life. When my father died, he was a young man and was just enough older than me that he was my hero. Always has been my hero, and his interest in law and politics was a very strong influence on me. another person that I see, he's not a hero, although he's an acquaintance, and maybe even call him a friend, I'll call him an anti-hero, is Don Hanai, as an attorney in town. When I left the Attorney General's office, I worked for the Attorney General's office from 1974 to 1979. I came back and went into practice, worked for my uncle's law firm for 3 years, and then for 5 years before I became elected judge, I went into private practice and was a solo practitioner. But I rented space in a building that Attorney Hanai was in, and wasn't working for him. I really didn't have too many cases with him. But as often the case with people work together, you get to talk a lot and observe each other and have a drink after work with them and maybe do the occasional case together. And I was able to see him operate. And I'll tell this to his face, but I saw how not to do lots of things. I saw how the old system operated and how I was not going to operate under that old system. He's just an unbelievably dynamic person, though. I mean, whether you like him or hate him, if you can get over your hate of him, as many people just have this loathing hatred for him. If you can get over that, the guy's very entertaining. There's no question that he's a brilliant man. He's a master in the courtroom. I mean, he has more, I can't think of quite the word that be acceptable in a class, but maybe chutzpah. Is the Jewish expression for it, that he just has the temerity to do anything. I mean, you know, he'll say the most outrageous things sometimes, or, you know, I mean, that's just him. That's Don Hanai. And, you know, I mean, from attempting to intimidate or browbeat or physically attack somebody to being the best cross-examiner that I've ever heard, to do all sorts of things of questionable ethics, you know, that you almost have to laugh. On one hand, you're appalled, but on the other, you say, "Oh my God!" You know, only Hannah would do something like that, you know. And he's certainly a memorable character. There've been a few others. I mean, there's a few good friends. A friend of mine is a police detective. By the name of Harry Wallet. He was a memorable character in my mind. I mean, he's a little bit younger than me, actually, but he acts like he's a 60-year-old guy, and he's got one story after another that are literally hysterical. He's a good-hearted person that very willing to make himself the butt of a joke if necessary, and he was certainly a character that influenced me to a great extent. I've been fortunate. When you're a judge, especially, you end up meeting an awful lot of people. a lot of powerful people. The title judge opens an awful lot of doors for you, and you just meet people that you know, that you wouldn't otherwise meet, and you know, the DeBartolos. You know, I've met Mr. DeBartolo. Actually, I met him when I represented the Racing Commission because he owned Thistledown Racetrack. Met and known him, and just his money and power have, you know, made an impression on me. Bill Caffaro, likewise, the same thing. I look back on some of the teachers that I had at Notre Dame were quite memorable. One guy that made a strong impression on me was Joe Theismann. Joe Theismann was a good friend of mine, the quarterback for Notre Dame and for the Washington Redskins. Here's a guy that the most memorable thing about him is I never met anybody in my life that had such a confidence about himself. And it wasn't arrogance. It really wasn't. I mean, it was just a total confidence that if he got in his head that he could walk through that wall, he would walk right towards it like he was going to walk through it. And when he didn't, he would, you know, why didn't that work? You know, I mean, he just was totally convinced he could do it. And when he came to Notre Dame, I mean, he was under-recruited. Like one other major school in the country recruited him. And Notre Dame had two quarterbacks that year they recruited, and one got hurt permanently and wasn't able to even come to Notre Dame, and the other at the last minute switched to another school. So they had no quarterback for the freshman class. So they got him at the last minute, bottom of the barrel, just to run the freshman football team. They never expected him to play. And yet, he knew he was going to be playing in the NFL. He couldn't tell him that, Joe, you're lucky to be here. He's, I'm going to start, you know. And he was skinny and small, and he just had that attitude. And it worked. I mean, I remember the first game he started for Notre Dame was against Southern Cal, and he was lived right next door to me. And so I got to know him pretty well. But when we were, I forget if we were sophomores or juniors, I think we were a sophomore, and Hanratty was the quarterback. He got hurt, and Southern Cal came up, traditional rival, tough team. First pass Joe throws from about the 20-yard line was intercepted, run back for a touchdown. It didn't bother him a bit. He didn't miss a beat. It was like I talked to him after the game. No problem. I knew that was just a lucky catch. And I was like, Joe, this guy's an All-American. You know, now you're in the hole. You're going to lose this game. What's going through your head? It didn't bother him a bit. He just said, well, the guy was lucky. You know, and he came back, and we ended up tying that game. And he was mad because people dropped passes that he just put on the money. And he was right. He had that attitude, that winning way about him that... And there's a lesson there, you know, that if you feel strongly enough about something and positively enough, you're going to win. When I ran for office, I just felt that I was going to win. I felt I was the best candidate. I was putting my trust in God, really, and I wasn't worried about whether I was going to win or lose because I felt that I should, and if God wanted me to, I would. Boy, that just, people sense that, you know, and they like that. They feel that about you. And that's why I won, I think, in large part. That's why Theismann was successful, because he was confident. And he always made an impression on me in that respect. You know, I wish I had that confidence. You know, I don't have quite that all the time, you know. And but he had it. That was something.
Last question. I don't know exactly how to phrase this, but do people's attitudes ever play a role in sentencing? Like, if somebody come in and is just a complete...
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of the problem that you have sometimes, that if you're not tolerant and you don't understand that, if you're not sensitive to that issue or that question, you get people all the time. A perfect example, and I'll do one based on race. I get two young men, one white, one black. White kid comes to court and both charged with the same thing. White kid, and this is a generalization, but very often will come with a mother and a father. He'll come with a suit and a tie. He'll have graduated from high school. He has a job. He's not on welfare. He's in tears. He doesn't want to go to jail. He's, you know, he's apologetic. He feels bad. He wants to. He shows genuine remorse. His mother and father tell me they're going to work out with him, and they're very much concerned about the whole situation. That kid's a great candidate for probation. I mean, there's no question that when the next kid comes up, and he, let's say he's black, and let's say his father's nowhere to be found. Very often the case. His mother doesn't come to court. I'm amazed at how many 19-year-old kids come to court without any parent or relative showing up for him. That's just the way it is. He comes in with the Raiders jacket on, and blue jeans, and slouches, and, you know, maybe that's just the way he grew up. Maybe he doesn't have a tie and a suit, you know, but he doesn't come, never will come dressed up. He comes in, and he's got tennis shoes on, and his hat on sideways, and I got to tell him to take his hat off, and yeah, no, you know, never answering any questions with yes, sir, no, your honor, shuffling his feet. Now, part of that, I have to be sensitive. One, you know, maybe he doesn't have the money for the clothes. Maybe he's afraid because it's an all-white system that seems to be oppressing him, and that he doesn't know what to say or how to say it. And maybe he doesn't have a father around to come in for him, or a mother's working someplace. And, you know, so... But yeah, I mean, you get two people like that. Let's say to make things worse, the kid doesn't do anything evil, but he's got a couple of things on his record, you know. There's no doubt those two people are going to be treated dramatically different, even in the most tolerant of judges. Even a black judge, you know, if you want to get race into it. Judge Haynes wouldn't, when he was a predecessor here, he was black. You know, he would treat people dramatically different based on that. So, yeah, I mean, and part of it's a con job. And we have such a high volume here that we can't always know. We have to make decisions on somebody sometimes in 15 or 20 seconds, whether or not they're going to jail or going on probation or somewhere in between. And so, yeah, how you look makes a big difference. Kid comes in and seems sincerely apologetic, again, black or white. You know, oftentimes it's going to be that white kid that's got a little better family structure, maybe, and then maybe a little better environment, maybe knows somebody. And whatever the reason, that's the image he's going to present. Someone else comes in and does present that same image, you know, they're going to go to jail much more likely. And then that kind of continues the process, you know. So now then he becomes a hardened criminal. And then now the next time he comes back, his record's even longer. And, you know, he's going to say, oh, well, I'm not getting a fair shake anyway, so why should I bother? So... You know, he's going to go to jail the next time, too. But that's the way it is. I mean, we are human beings, and we have to... One, we're going to make things based on the values that are important to us, and even if you try to be tolerant and fair and open-minded, certain things are going to be more important to you. Not just the color of the skin. It's going to be the way they dress, the way they act, the way they say things. Even if you're unconsciously doing it or subconsciously doing it, it happens. And the presentation that you make in terms of physical appearance and expressing yourself makes a huge difference in how you're treated in court.
Have you gotten burned?
Oh, yeah. No question about it. I've been burned numerous times. Just this past week I got burned by a guy. He came in, he's... in tears. Judge, please don't send me to jail. I've got my kid at home. I just got him back from Children's Services. I'm trying to make a new life. I'm trying to help. I mean, I felt bad for the guy. He was a young black man, wasn't very well dressed, and you know, but he just seemed like a nice guy. It seemed like he was trying to do something about it. I wanted to give him a break. It was the first time I'd ever had him. So I said, okay, I'm going to give you a break. I'm going to let you out of jail. I only had him in jail for 12 hours or something. And I said, don't mess up. 2 days later, he was back in charge for theft again. I mean, you know, prostitutes, you know, you get a lot of them. You know, they're junkies. They want help. They don't want to be there. You know, they're crying. I'm a softie when somebody cries, you know, so I give them a break. They're back a week later with 3 tickets, you know. That just happens all the time. And yeah, you get burned. And what you have to do, though, is you have to be careful not to overreact to that either to that particular defendant or to anybody else. I mean, you can't say, oh, well, boy, you really made me look bad, and I'm going to give you 6 months for some charge that really doesn't merit 6 months. You can't get mad at them. And you also can't say, well, every time I get a prostitute in here, I'm going to you know, thrown in jail, not listen to a sob story, or any time I have a shoplifter. You can't do that. People are different. You know, people are desperate. They don't want to be in jail. I don't blame them for that. You know, I'm an old defense lawyer, see, and I think it's important for people who become judges have seen all sides. You know, oftentimes we get the guy who's a prosecutor, never had a private practice, and you know, moves right to the bench and still has a prosecutorial mentality. You know, I'm a defense lawyer. I mean, I know that what these people are saying. I know that they're lying. That doesn't bother me so much. I can generally find it out. Yeah, it will affect me if I think that they're lying to me, but we used to say in the defense bar, you know, the lawyers that represented criminal defendants, that you have a constitutional right to lie. And, you know, nobody wants to admit it. They're going to not tell you the truth. I have to expect that. I mean, if I were in the same situation, charged with a crime that I could go to jail with, and I came to court, took an oath, and I thought I could get away with lying about it, I would be lying too. I mean, that's just human nature. That doesn't bother me. But there are some judges that, you know, they go crazy when that happens. You know, they think that, I think they get a little too personal with the respect to which they're entitled or the stature of their position, and, you know, that they may be a little idealistic, or I don't know what the problem is, but they can't believe that somebody would actually lie to them. Well, I do. I expect everybody to be lying, you know, and police officers are lying or exaggerating, if not lying. You know, witnesses exaggerate. Sometimes it's even just their perception. You know, it's their, they don't even realize that their position, you know, if this is a friend or an enemy, whether it's white or black, whether it's rich versus poor, you know, where they're coming from is going to affect their perception of the situation. You know, white middle class or upper middle class person, middle aged, driving through on Hillman Street, gets stopped by a car and gets approached by a few young black men that are, you know, talking jive and listening to music and goofing around. You know, is going to feel extremely intimidated. These people were threatening my life. Where in actuality, you know, they weren't. They were just, that's the way they operate. So, and person that's in that class may come around and say, oh no, that didn't happen at all. They were just, matter of fact, they were trying to be friendly. They were trying to give her directions. You know, just depends on what your point of view is. And you have to always remember that. You know, that people, even if they're not intentionally telling a lie or a fabrication, their own perception of reality changes their testimony and how they're relating it to you.
Real quick. You want to go higher?
Oh, absolutely. If only for ego gratification. I love this job, and I want to stay here for a while. And every time I talk about it, I've only been here 3.5 years, and I've had several opportunities that I've turned down. Governor's office wanted to appoint me to take Judge Joyce's place in the juvenile court. There's a new job open up here for the fifth judgeship. Mike Gerchek ended up winning it. Mike himself came to me 3-4 times and begged me to run for that job. And everybody that he ran against in that race, the top three finishers all said if I were running that they wouldn't even be in it. And I had other situations, but on one hand, when I talk to people in a political sense about what I can win and what I can do, and yeah, you get excited about a campaign, and then someone else might come up to me and say, well, how do you like your job? And I almost have tears in my eyes sometimes. I love my job. You know, this is my ministry. I go on like that. And I say, what am I talking about? Why would I want to leave this? You know, but it gets hard. One of the things is financial. I mean, I'm having some problems. I have a son I want to educate at private schools. And, you know, I just don't ever seem to have enough money. I see my contemporaries out there making six-figure incomes in a private practice law, and I'm limited in what I can make, and I'm also taxed on every penny that I receive, which is a downer. I don't have any deductions or exemptions or anything like that. And so financially, I think about actually leaving the bench completely because of the money, or moving up where you get more pay as you move up the ladder. I mean, I know that I will. I'm only 41 years old. You know, right now I'm the most well-known, most highly visible judge in the county. I mean, I could probably run for anything that's out there and win it if I wanted to, but I'm not quite ready to give up this. Again, if I run for something, I'm afraid that it's just a gratification of my own ego and not doing what is God's will. I think that I'm here for a purpose and that I have to spend some time here and do a good job. My people need me, I'd like to say, you know, and without any, you know, I don't mean to be arrogant or anything. I say that in a truly humble way. I mean, there are poor souls out there that need someone to listen to them and to watch out for them, and I think I can do that. But yeah, at some point in time, I know that I will move on, and it's hard to say where you will go. One of the problems with being a judge is that our canons of ethics don't let us run for a non-judicial position. I would have to resign. I mentioned before my uncle ran for Congress. It's always, you know, in the back of my head, I would like to vindicate the family name and win that job, you know. I think I'd be a good congressman, but I'd have to resign my job, and as long as I've got a family to support, and, you know, I don't have any great amounts of money set aside, and I don't have any independent wealth, I have to look at my position as my paycheck as well. I have to be conservative in what I do. But certainly a common police court bench is a possibility if one opened up. But I'm looking very seriously going to the Court of Appeals either next year or in 1996 when there's a judge that will be retiring due to age, and I'd like to succeed him if I can wait that long. And I mean, at my age, and I think my track record so far, and the image that I present to the public as a campaigner and as a public official, I think that I could go all the way to the House Supreme Court, and that's not out of the picture.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.